My name is Rabbi Avi Strasberg. I'm based in Maryland. And in our time together, we're going to be looking at three new midrashim, midrashim that were written post October 7th, three midrashim that were written by Dr. Norit Hirschfeld Skupinski. Just a little bit of background on the midrashim before we dig into them. So these midrashim will be published in the third collection of Dershuni. Dershuni, if it's new to you, it's a collection of modern midrashim written by Israeli women, edited by Tamar Biala. Dershuni in general as a collection, it's bringing, they're all feminist in different ways, highlighting perspectives that we might not have heard before, or even just in the voices that they're bringing in or the characters or narratives that we're choosing to focus on. And since October 7th, there's been a number of women who have been, with no surprise, turning to writing, turning to Torah, turning to Midrash as a way of kind of making sense and finding language and processing and holding the pain. And so this sort of collection of midrashim that are being created after October 7th as a way of, again, making sense of that. Specifically, Dr. Norit Hirschfeld Skupinski, we're going to be looking at a set of three of her midrashim that are both stand on its own, but they're all a unit. Dr. Hirschfeld Skupinski's background, she's Israeli. She is a professor of Talmud and of Midrash. And her focus before October 7th, for many, many years when she's been teaching her students, she was drawn to teaching about Midrashei Chorban, about Midrashim of destruction. That was always sort of the genre she was in, the story she sort of specialized in. And she said after October 7th, these stories that for years she had been teaching about from a literary, from an academic perspective, they sort of like came off the page, that these stories of, you know, Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni, of the two temples being destroyed, you know, she was like seeing the destruction of her own house and of the houses around her. And these stories that she had been teaching about, you know, from a certain distance for years with the love and intimacy, but from a distance, suddenly these were the stories that she felt like were being lived out now. And she said for these series of midrashim that we're going to learn together, she said that they basically just wrote themselves, that they like came pouring out of her. And I think that you'll feel that in the writing. So Dr. Norit Hirschfeld Skupinski, she is from Nachal Oz. Nachal Oz is one of the kibbutzim that's close to the border of Gaza. On October 7th, she was with her family, her husband, and her children all night, all day in the mamad, in the safe room that was in their house. They heard the terrorists that were in their house. They heard the shooting. They heard the yelling. She said afterwards when they were able to eventually leave the mamad, she said anything that wasn't stolen was destroyed. The army, the Israeli army, then eventually used their house as like a base point that then after the terrorists had left their house, the army was in their house. So their house has been, you know, sort of like totally taken over in that way. Norit, along with all of the other families of Nachal Oz, were evacuated. And she said, now families are just, some families are just beginning to be allowed to come back. And she said for herself, she said, like, there are the people that know they're going to go back, and there are the people that know they're not going to go back. And she said, we're somewhere in between of sort of that longing and wanting and thinking of home. But she said, the home that we left is not the home that's there anymore. I had the chance to speak to her in preparing to share these midrashim with you. And when I spoke to her, I didn't realize, but she had a Zoom background on that I thought was just the house that she was in. You know, there was white walls behind her and three paintings hanging on the wall. There was a table behind her, a wooden table with one placemat set. And then she revealed that that wasn't actually where she was. It was a Zoom background. It was a photo of her house that's still standing, but that she can no longer be in. She said the table's not there anymore. The paintings aren't on the wall anymore. And she said Zoom is the one place where she could still be in her bite, where she could still be in her house. There was something very powerful about that. So Norit is from Nachal Oz. Just to give you a little bit of context, that's the place from which she is writing these midrashim. From Nachal Oz, there were 15 people that were murdered on October 7th. And since then, there were 7 people that were taken hostage, 5 people were returned. And there are 2 men that are still hostage, that are still in captivity. One of them is Tzachi Idan, who is 51. Tzachi has 3 kids. His eldest daughter, Mayan, was killed on October 7th. And Umri Miran, who is 46 and has a wife and has 2 kids. So when we are reading these midrashim, I think Dr. Hirschfeld-Skupinski is writing about lots of families, but she's also, I'm sure, holding dear the people from Nachal Oz and thinking about those people. I just want to share one more thing with you before we actually turn to the language of the midrashim. You know, I teach a lot of midrashim from Dir Shuni. It's just Torah that I'm really called to, but it's not often that I actually am in close correspondence with the people, with the writers of the midrashim. But with these particular midrashim, it felt important because it's like the midrashim are really their writing, their stories. I think what we're doing here today in our time together is we're bearing witness to people's, to these stories, that there's no separation here. It feels to me that there's very little separation between the midrash and the writer. And so it felt particularly important to connect with her and to hear more about her story and what was motivating it. And so when I was asking permission to connect and permission to teach her midrashim in this context, I'm going to read you what she wrote me in an email in Hebrew, and then I'll try to translate it for you. So she said, "Kemi shehistatra im kol b'nei ha-mishpacha sha'ot arukot me'od b'mamad b'otah shabbat." She said, as someone who was hidden with all the members of my family long hours in the mamad, in the safe room on that Shabbat, b'dmama, b'choser onim u'b'pachad mavet, in silence, in helplessness, and in fear of death, hayedi'a she'milim sheli megi'ot le'mechozot she'me'ever li, u'fortzot et kirot ha'mamad. She said, the knowledge that my words are sort of arriving to someplace else that is beyond me, and that they are bursting through, breaking down the walls of the safe room. Mehave tikkun. It's like a form of tikkun, a form of correction. Tikkun l'dmama v'tikkun l'netisha. A form of sort of healing or correcting that silence for all of those hours where they had to be silent, and that feeling of abandonment. So I feel it's like particularly both for me to share her Torah with you today, but also for all of us to be reading these words and spending time with these midrashim and spending time with the stories of these people. This is like you're hearing from the author herself that this is really important, that it's like it's a breaking down for all of those hours where she had to be silent. She also said when I talked to her, she said, "I had to be silent for so many hours. I was so afraid. And now I don't have to be afraid anymore. I'm just screaming it out." So it's like, I want you to feel that her words are breaking through the walls of the mamad, of the safe room, and they're arriving to us. I just need to give you one more bit of context before we dive in. So it's a set of three midrashim, and there's sort of like this opening paragraph that's going to be the framing to the three midrashim. And in that opening framing, she references a line from a midrash from Bereishit Rabbah. So the midrash that she references from Bereishit Rabbah, it's a story, it's a mashal, it's a parable that imagines two gladiators fighting it out to the death in sort of some sort of public arena, and that there is a king watching. And in the midrash, it says, "Kashim hadvarim le'omram ve'i efshar lepele for sham." It's difficult to say, and it's impossible to explicate, to articulate these things. And then the thing that's said in the midrash is, it's difficult to say and impossible to articulate, but there is this king that seems to be enjoying the benefit of watching these two gladiators go at it. It's for the king's benefit. And the king at any point could intercede and could stop the fighting. And yet, why doesn't the king stop the fighting? And then in the midrash, it says, and then the victim, once the victim is down, the victim calls out to the heavens, who will seek justice for me? Who will seek justice? Because the king seems to not be doing anything. And I think the idea of the midrash, kashima dorim le'omram v'yevshar lepele for sham, it's hard to say these things and even impossible to explicate, is that we're supposed to, in the midrash, in the classic midrash, read that perhaps God is stepping in the king in the parable. And it's like, where is, in the same way that the king is sort of allowing the gladiators to fight it out and not stepping in, there's a question in the midrash that we don't dare say. It's like the midrash is even comfortable raising the question, but what is God's role in this arena, and why isn't God stepping in? And so she's going to reference a line from that in her midrash. Okay, so again, this is the three midrashim are all from Dr. Nurit Hirschfeld-Skupinski. It's a set of three. So she begins, this is sort of the framing for all three. She writes, "V'ksheharav habayit, v'ksheharav aleinu olameinu b'shiva be'oktober, when the house was destroyed, and here she's using habayit as both like bayit, as in reminding us of Beit HaMikdash, the temple, on Tisha B'Av, and bayit as in the home, when the house was destroyed, when the house was, when our world was destroyed upon us on the 7th of October, Domeh haya aleinu ki sipurei ha-chorban. It was similar to us, like the stories of the destruction, meaning destruction of the temple, yatsu mitoch ha-otiyot benot alafayim, that they, these stories that sort of came out from these letters that were thousands of years old, 2,000 years old. Hamilim karmu or, these words sort of took on a skin, vegidim, and flesh, v'niyeh l'metziyut akshavit avela chafuya v'davya. And they became a reality that was very much now, a reality of mourning and of grieving and of anguish. V'kashima devarim le'omram v'iyevshar le'pelefosham. And it's difficult to say these things, and it's impossible to articulate them. So this is just sort of the opening framing. And this is like, this is really where you really hear her as the author, her as the scholar who has been teaching about these stories of Korban HaBayit for all these years. And it's like these words of these that she had been teaching for so long, it's like they took on flesh. They became real flesh as she's seeing it in the stories around her. It's difficult to even say. So this is, each of her midrashim is very much based on a classic rabbinic midrash, because again, that's her work as a scholar. She was like seeing it all in relationship to these midrashim she's been teaching for all of these years. So first we're going to read the classic midrash. This isn't hers. This comes from Eicha Rabba, and then we'll read her midrash on this. So the midrash says, Ma'aseh b'Miriam bat Tanchum, there's a story of Miriam bat Tanchum, shenishbeti v'shivat baneha, that she was taken captive and seven of her sons. Netalan kesaru netanan legav min shiv'a kankalim. The Caesar took them and put them into seven different rooms, the seven different sons. He brings the first son in and says to him, bow to the idol. And the son says, God forbid, I won't bow to this idol. Amarlo lama. Caesar, the Caesar says, why not? And then the son answers, it's written in our Torah, it's written in the Torah, I am your God and you should not have other gods before you. And so the son martyrs himself and refuses to bow. Miyad hotzio v'hargo, and the Caesar immediately takes him out and kills the first son. This happens with each, the midrash is long, it happens with each of the successive sons, that he brings the second son and says, bow to the idol, and the son refused this too, he brings the third son, and so on, finally kills each of the sons in succession, finally gets to the seventh son. He takes out the seventh son, and he was the smallest of them. He says to the son, my son, so it's kind of interesting that he uses that language, Beni, the Caesar. He says, Beni, son, bow to the idol. Amar lo chas v'shalom, he says, God forbid, no. Miyad tziva alav v'hargo. He immediately gives the command to kill him. Nafla imo alav, his mother falls upon the son that is about to be killed. V'ayta mechabko menachshto, she was hugging him and kissing him. V'amra lo beni, she says, my son. Lech etzel Abraham avichem, go to Abraham, your father, meaning of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's about to die, the son. So she says, when you get there, go to Abraham, Isaac, go to Abraham. The Amorlo, and say to him, Kach amra imi. This is what my mom says. Al tazuach da'atcha alecha v'tomar baniti mizbeach. He says, she says, the mother says to the son that's about to be killed, the seventh and final son, go to Abraham and don't say to him, don't be so full of yourself. Don't be saying, I built a mizbeach, I built an altar, v'he'leti et yitzchak bani, and I put my son Isaac on the altar. How great am I that Abraham should be so full of himself that he made the sacrifice? Re'imenu banta shiva mizbechot. Say to him, my mother built seven altars, v'he'elta shiva banim beyom echad, and put upon them seven children on one day. Say to him, atani sayon ve'ani ma'aseh. You were the test, you were the trial, but you didn't have to actually go through it. You didn't have to actually give anything up. V'ani ma'aseh, and I am the deed. I am the action that my mom had to actually sacrifice her seven children. In the time that she was kissing him and hugging him, it was decreed and they killed him. They killed him upon her. After some time, the same woman sort of lost her mind. And she fell from the roof and she died. To fulfill that which was written in Yirmiyahu, in the book of Jeremiah, Umlala yoledet tashiva, miserable is the one that gives birth to seven. Uvat kol yotzet ve'omeret, and sort of the divine feminine voice cries out and says, Eim habanim smecha, from Psalms, the mother of children is happy. It seems like there's something sort of like cynical that is being said here, something ironic, like the mother should be happy, and here we have this mother that is in mourning. The Ruach HaKodesh tzovachat ve'omeret al ele anim bochia, from Echa, and the Holy Spirit cries out and says, for these ones, I cry, quoting from Echa. So this is just the Midrash. This is not Nurit's Midrash. It's a strange and interesting Midrash of Miriam Bat Tanchum, whose seven children basically martyr themselves. And then on the seventh one, it's like she has this anger for Abraham, which is perhaps surprising to us. We don't think of, Abraham is our ancestor that we look up to, that we respect, that, you know, she, it's like there is this defiance to, it's not even to the Caesar. It's not to the person who is doing the killing. It's to Abraham. There's this defiance of Abraham. Don't think, you know, the one that she should have held as her people. Don't think that you were so great. You didn't sacrifice anything. You didn't give anything up. And I'm giving up my seven children. And then ultimately, she dies. She falls from the roof and she dies. Okay, so let's see what Dr. Hirschfeld Kupinski does with it. Shecharava bayit nirtzechu shivat baneha shel Miriam bat Tanchum lenega eneha. When the temple was destroyed, the seven children, the seven sons of Miriam bat Tanchum, were killed before her. Shesirvu lehishtachavot letzelem, because they refused to bow down to the idol. When the time came to kill the last of her sons, Miriam bat Tanchum asked of her smallest son, my son, go to Abraham, your father, meaning, you know, Abraham Avinu. Say to him, this is what my mom said, Al tazuch da'atcha lecha Tomar baniti mizbech ve'aleti et Yitzchak b'ni. Don't be so full of yourself to say that I built an altar and I brought up Yitzchak, my son, upon it. Hare imenu bantash shiv'a mizbechot ve'elta shivat banim b'yom echad. Right? This is just quoting of the story before. You should say, my mother, you know, built seven altars and brought up seven sons on the altar in one day. Atani sayon ve'ani ma'aseh. You were the test. You didn't have to actually go through with it. You didn't have to give anything up, but I'm the deed. Nishecharav alenu olaminu b'shiva b'October, when our world was destroyed upon us on the 7th of October. Amdu saftot sabim, dodot v'dodim, mul batim srufim, v'charvim shel mishpachot shlemot shehayu einan od. There stood grandfathers and grandmothers, aunts and uncles in front of houses that were burned and destroyed, of complete families that are no longer. B'mabat halom v'domem k'mo ponim el ba'alei ha-ma'amad, in a look of sort of shocked, silent before the face of authority. V'asara emunim al bitchonam v'atida shel ha'uma, those that were entrusted with the security and the future of their nation. Zo'okim be'ema, they scream in terror. Eifo hayitem. Where were you? We are the deed, and you didn't stand the trial. Miriam bat Tanchum yada ki yadeham bacharu b'mavet. Bilvad shelo yaru al yareg v'yavor. Miriam bat Tanchum, she knew that her children chose death, that they at least made a choice, an active choice, to not transgress, that you should not, you know, yareg v'yavor, meaning one of the three big sins, as you shouldn't, if you're, you know, forced to commit idolatry, you should die rather than do it. And they made a choice. They had a choice there. And they chose not to transgress and to allow themselves to be died. V'sofa she'nishtet v'nafla min ha'gag u'meta. And in the end, she lost her mind. She fell from the roof and she died. And the Ruach HaKodesh tzovachat ve'omeret al ele ani bochia. And the Holy Spirit cries out and says, quoting from Echa, on these ones I cry. Ve'ilu b'nei mishpachot ele, but for these families, what will be for them?
Shefilu nechama porta zeldonim tzetlehem. Even the small bit of comfort they don't have. Ma titvach ruach hakodesh al neshot v'anshei ha'otev. Shenimchaku mizbechoteim v'yom echan. What will the Holy Spirit say about these women, these men and women of the Gaza envelope, this area close to Gaza, whose entire families were erased in one day? Nori brings this midrash from Eicha to say, at least in this horrible midrash in Eicha, where seven of her children were killed in one day, Miriam Batanchum had the comfort of knowing that her children chose this, that they martyred themselves in this like active way. They made a decision. And there was even comfort for her, perhaps, in the end, because she loses her mind and she dies. And there's the comfort of the Holy Spirit crying out and saying, Al ele ani bochia. But she says, for the families of October 7th, for the people that survived, for all the people that were lost, what comfort is there for those people whose families were just, there was no choice. These were just people that were murdered or were taken. Where is the comfort? And there's a sense when she says, Matitzavach Ruach HaKodesh, what's the Holy Spirit going to cry out now? I think that there's a call out to God of, is God here now? What is God saying now? What can be said about these families? What can be said about this horror, about these families, you know, entire families? I remember in the aftermath of October 7th, some of the photos that were circulating on social media of, like, you know, the beautiful, beautiful, happy families, parents with their kids, and like the family is no longer. And this is the midrash. It's like, what can be said about those? And so for Nuri, I think this is like, you know, all of these midrashim, it's like the connection between a house destroyed, the bayit shecharav, the house that was destroyed of the temple, and the house that is destroyed today. She's seeing them as like, it's all one story that's playing out today. The story of Miriam Batanchum and the seven sons. And the story of the families, the mothers and fathers and children and the aunts and uncles and grandparents. You know, going back to this opening, her beautiful language, that it's like the words, Hamilim Karmu or Vegidim Veniyu Lemetziut Achshavit Avela. The words were made flesh, becoming a grieving, anguished, despondent reality. That it's like this thing that was so long ago, the destruction of the temple, sort of, we see it. There's such a, you know, that you could see the way that this story could just pour out of her, this midrash.
Hi, it's Rabbi Avi Killip again. That was a powerful and painful midrash. But before we continue, I want to let you know that the next midrash that we're about to encounter deals with sexual violence and rape. So take care as you choose whether to continue listening.
The original story is in Aramaic. I'm going to read it for you in Hebrew, just so that we have it a little bit easier. So the sister of Bruria was the wife of Rabbi Meir. The sister of Bruria was at some point, this is in the Talmud, was taken captive and was being held captive in a brothel. So there was both concern for her safety and concerned what was happening while she was being held captive against her will in a brothel. And this is the story. I'm just going to read it for you in the Hebrew again, remembering that the original is actually up here in the Aramaic. Bruria, the wife of Rabbi Meir, the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Tardion, she said to him, "It disgraces me that my sister is sitting in a brothel." She said that to Rabbi Meir. He took a basket of dinars of money and he went. He said, "If a sin was not done with her, a miracle will be done. If she has sinned, then no miracle will be done for her." The idea seems to be Bruria is upset, wants Rabbi Meir, her husband, to go and somehow get her sister out of captivity. And he says, if she has sinned, meaning if someone has had sex with her, meaning if she has presumably been raped in this captivity in which she is in, then no miracle will be done for her. She'll have to remain there. But if she has not sinned, meaning if she has not had sex with anyone, or God forbid, anyone has not raped her, then a miracle will be done for her. That's the story in the Talmud. If sin was not done with her, a miracle will be done. If she sinned, no miracle will be done with her. He went and disguised himself as one of the Calvary men. He said to her, "Obey me." She said to him, "I'm menstruating." She sort of like puts him off. He said to her,
unclear in the Aramaic. It could mean one of two things. Either he says to her, like, I'm burning up, or he says to her some version of, like, it's okay, I'll wait. Meaning, but either way, it's like a, he's not being so quick to be. She tries to deflect him and says, I'm menstruating, I can't have sex with you now. And he's like, either I really want it or I'll wait. She said to him, either, it's hard to understand the Aramaic, either I'm bleeding heavily, or she says to him some version of, like, there's a lot of other women here. Take your pick. There's a lot of other women. He learned from this, Rabbi Meir learned from this, that she hadn't sinned and she must have said this to everyone who came to her. Okay, so Rabbi Meir basically disguises someone, tries to proposition the sister of Boria. She puts him off multiple times. And from this, he learns she must have somehow managed to not be violated during that time. And then it seems like, therefore, a miracle will be done for her and she'll be saved. This is the story in the Gemara. It is, you know, as I heard Dr. Hirschfeld Skupinski talk about it, she said for her, it was a very disturbing story of, like, what does it mean that only if, you know, God forbid, she hadn't been raped, then a miracle will be done for her and she'll be saved. Rabbi Meir will be able to redeem her. But if she hadn't, you know, but if she had been, then, like, therefore a miracle couldn't be done, that there's something that feels very problematic in the story. And so to this, she writes this midrash. She writes, "V'ksheharav habayit v'kocham shel biryanim gavar," that when the house was destroyed, again, this is like all, it's like harav habayit, we think of the destruction of the temple, and now we're also thinking of destruction of all of the houses on October 7th. "V'ksheharav habayit v'kocham shel biryanim gavar," and the power of the thugs sort of was strengthened. "Nechtefa achota shel broya v'husma v'kuba shel zonot." So this is seems like it's talking about the story in the Gemara. Boria's sister was grabbed, was seized, and she was placed in this kubah shel zonot, in this brothel. "Mabata v'kola shel Boria hadocheket v'ba'ala lik'ot achota," sort of the gaze and the voice of Boria was pleading with her husband to redeem her sister. "Zo'akim et cherdoteha mechilul haguf v'hanefesh b'toch ha'ofel b'toch hazva'ah." Cried her terror from the desecration of the body and the soul in the darkness and horror. The Rebbe Meir, Mahu Amar, and Rebbe Meir, what does he say in the original Torah story in the Talmud? "Im lo na'ase ba isur, ya'ase nes. Im asta isur, lo ya'ase la nes." If there wasn't anything forbidden that happened, then a miracle will be performed for her. And if there was something forbidden that happened with her, meaning she had presumably been raped, then a miracle won't be performed for her. "Lemi netuna da'aga." Who were they worried about? Who is that story in the Talmud worried about? "Lo lahachei nafsha shel isha umlala," not about the emotional well-being of this poor, wretched woman of her sister that had been taken captive. "Ki im ledikdukei halacha." Rather, it's concerned about the precision, the precise points of halacha. Right, that it's not the in the story in the Talmud, there's an accusation that she is leveling at really at Chazal, at the rabbis that are crafting the story. That's like they're concerned about her purity. They're concerned about whether she has been violated, whether someone had sex with her, and such that if they have, she can be redeemed, or if she hadn't, thank God, then she can be redeemed. But they're not really concerned about her, they're concerned about halacha. That she'll be saved through the means of a miracle only if she's found pure. In a place in which there is no freedom, they are demanding from her, expecting from her that she behave like a free person who is able to actually say no. When there's no freedom, there can be no expectation that is placed on her in that situation. And thankfully, Rebbe Meir goes and finds her pure, and he is able to redeem her from captivity. Atmaha, this is startling. This is strange. Ilu ne'ensa b'shevi lo haya mitchayem la'nes. God forbid, if she was raped in captivity, then a miracle wouldn't be performed for her. When I talked to Norit about this text, she said she was enraged by the text in Talmud. How could it be that we're talking about women being held hostage, and what Chazal, what the rabbis are concerned about is whether or not someone has had sex with them such that that's like whether or not they can be redeemed or not. If only if she hadn't been raped, then it would be okay to save them. But if not, perhaps not. She goes on and says, "V'anu, ksheharav alinu alaminu b'shiva b'oktober," but us, when our world was destroyed upon us on the 7th of October, "ra'inu nashim ve'almot nechtafot, v'shamu osninu siporez va'ot ve'inus." We saw women, young women who were taken captive, and our ears heard the stories of horror and of rape. From that moment, our hearts haven't stopped bleeding or writhing. And our souls have not stopped being sort of like ravaged. And our bodies have been hurting. Our bodies haven't stopped hurting with all of our heart and with all of our might. For these same women who haven't seen the light of day, and who haven't seen the light of humanity, a darkness is holding them, controlling them. Their bodies are desecrated and their spirits are ravaged. Our cries are touching to their cries and are hoping for their redemption and for their release. And calling for sort of the miracles and the powers above to move the strengths of below. Ad sheyatzilu otan mishivyan v'yatzilu otan b'shovan. Until that they're able to save them from their captivity and save them on their return. So a couple of things here. One is, I think she's highlighting there is a call out to the, you know, I think that story in the Talmud was always a story that bothered her. There's a call out to the rabbis in the Talmud that seem to be concerned more with halakha than with sort of the emotional well-being of the women. And she's saying, but we today, we are not like that. That we are, since we heard about these horrible stories of rape and the horrible things that were done to women, all we can do is think about that. And all we can do is hold them in our hearts. So one is just like a naming of the holding of the pain and the horror. Two is, I want to note this nosheket shabbatenu leshabbatan, that is like our cries are meeting their cries. I think there's something very powerful about that image that she's bringing together. It's like, even as maybe we are not with them, whether we are physically separated by them, because at the moment that she was writing this, people were, some of these women were still being held captive or sort of separated, you know, in spirit or by emotional distance. But that this idea that our cries are reaching out their cries, that's something that's come up as a theme in some of these midrashim post October 7th, of like the crying of a people together, of coming together in our crying. And also this idea of this calling on the powers above to move the powers below. That it's like, it can't be that people are just saved through a miracle. It can't be that we're just relying on miracles. It has to be that there's some combined force of like prayer and where is God in this story? And also like, what are people doing on the ground? What are we doing on the ground? What is the government doing on the ground? That it has to be both the God and prayer, and also kochot tachtonim, the forces below, have to be working together. And then the last thing that I'll just note, this ad sheyatzilu otan meshivyan veyatzilu otan meshovan, that's like, not only are we praying for their return, but we have to keep praying for them on their return. That it's like, even once they are returned, it's not just that they need to be saved from wherever they are, they need to be saved from wherever they get to. Because also, once they get back, these are horrors and the things that people experienced on October 7th or experienced or continuing to experience in captivity, this is something that's not just like they're saved once and then they come back, but it's something that they're going to need to be continued to be saved from. It's like, this is the keynote and these midrashim, it's that you could see that there's no separation between the writer and between the Torah. But it's like they are the midrashim that are being written out of directly out of their experience, out of their pain, out of their mourning and the loss. And so when we are learning the midrashim, it's like, this is the way that we can be sort of bearing witness to those stories. It's just a different way of getting a window into that. And I think the second thing is, you know, I don't know how these midrashim land with you today, but I would say often when I'm teaching texts, that it's like, and here's the takeaway. Not to tie it up in a bow, but it's like, here's the Torah that gives us a bit of hope or teaches us something about the world or the thing we want to take away. And I don't feel like I have that with these midrashim. I feel like these midrashim are just hard. As you wrote, Stuart, they're heartbreaking. That's what these midrashim are. These midrashim are, they leave you feeling kind of stunned and quiet before them. And I think that has to be okay. You know, I think sometimes we learn Torah and we have profound things to say about it. And sometimes we learn Torah, perhaps especially on Tisha B'Av, or especially these stories that are coming out of October 7th. And I think our role is perhaps just to be silent before them and to listen to it and to sit with it and to sit with the pain of it. So I think that we're going to end there. And I think that the sort of the line that I want to end on, you know, I said when I was learning this with Norit, I said that I wanted to end on, I asked her, does the order of the Midrash matter to you? And she actually had she had the Midrash that I put second that we didn't learn together. She had it last. Because you'll see when you look at it, that line from Breishit Rabbah that it's difficult to say, that appears in the first, and in the Midrash that I have now second, she had it last because she thought that was like a nice literary framing. The reason why I put this particular Midrash last is I feel like there is a note of hope in it. She wasn't quite willing to go there with me. She's like, I don't know if I would call it hope. So I think that's kind of interesting of whether or not in this last Midrash you can read any hope into it. But for me, it feels like there is some thing of hope, of this no sheket shavatenu l'shavatan, of our cries meeting their cries, of moving these forces above to move the forces below. And so that's the note that I want to end on, that on this day of mourning for the temple, and on this day of the ways in which the mourning of the bayit is so connected to the mourning of the batim, of the houses and of the families and of the lives, that our cries should reach their cries and our cries should touch each other's cries.